Well, no matter how we try to get rid of it with our frantic texting, tweeting, clicking, and crazy social schedules, boredom just won't go away. And if history's any judge, it's just part of the human condition. So why not understand it and embrace it? Well, that's what we aim to do this hour. I'm Veronica Rickert with you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie joins us this hour. She's a freelance journalist, and her recent article, The History of Boredom, ran in the Smithsonian Magazine. And also with us is John Eastwood. He is an associate professor of psychology at York University who's currently working to understand boredom. And we welcome your thoughts and feelings on the matter. What is your cure for boredom? Is it a necessary part of life, or are you in the market for a permanent cure? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, and our email is talk@wpr.org. You can also check in on our Facebook page at The Veronica Rickert Show. And Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
And John Eastwood, welcome.
Thank you, welcome.
And so, Linda, let's start with you. You just wrote a piece about the history of boredom, and crazily enough, there has recently been a new thing in England, the first boring conference. What was that about?
Well, the boring conference is actually the reason why I was interested in the subject of boredom, and it's a little bit of a misnomer. The boring conference actually wasn't boring at all. It was very interesting. It was started by a guy called James Ward here in the UK, and he has a blog and a Twitter account, and he writes about boring, sort of mundane things that he finds very interesting. So he actually has an entire blog dedicated to stationery, like paper products, which actually I got to say I kind of find interesting. I don't know, but he in about 2010. There was another writer here in the UK, Russell Davies, who wrote for Wired magazine, and he'd been running what was called the Interesting Conference, and it was just basically, you know, people coming together talking about stuff that they thought was interesting. And unfortunately, it was canceled, and so James tweeted, you know, maybe I should have the Boring Conference, and within about a half an hour, it was a thing, you know, so he had to do it. The best part about that, though, is that people who were scheduled to talk at the Interesting Conference just rehashed their talks for the Boring Conference. So it's sort of, I think for James Ward, boring and interesting are kind of two sides of the same coin.
It was fun to hear what people thought was boring. It was pylons and stationery and the double yellow lines on roads.
Yeah, I managed to get to the conference, which I have to confess is part of the reason why I wrote the article, is that I just really wanted to go to the conference and have a good reason to. So I managed to get there and catch a talk about the Yamaha PSR-175, a portable keyboard. that was a very funny talk. I heard a tour of Midwest Denny's restaurants, pretty good, and a talk about a website called Celeb Heights, which is sort of trying to figure out how tall celebrities are. And that was really funny. It was interesting. It was really interesting.
So it's sort of tongue-in-cheek is the point, is that no matter what the topic, if you attend to it with interest and dig out what's interesting about it, then it's not boring anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of gets to the idea that interest and interesting things is certainly subjective. And you know, I think that James Ward and the people who were helping him organize this were really a bit wary of it being cast as somehow ironic, that it was, you know, sort of ironic, like, you know, being interested in funny mustaches or things like that. They really did mean it quite earnestly. Like, these were things that people were interested in and could actually be very interested in. And sort of the idea of examining something that seems quite mundane and quite sort of day-to-day and possibly trivial and finding the sort of beauty, I guess, in it.
And John, let's go to you, because you're looking to understand boredom from a psychological perspective. And what Linda was getting at there about how when we have that attention that we pay to things, you know, we're not bored. Is that part of the definition of boredom, is when you're bored, you're really not paying attention to things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, in fact, that was, as you know, the main thrust of our recent work, where, you know, we noted that boredom was a very common human experience, and you know, associated with all kinds of psychological and social problems, and yet we knew very little about it. And so we wanted to try to look through the literature and find out about the common ways the different theoretical approaches have been trying to define the state, to come up with a definition that would be in common with all these different approaches. And as you're saying, indeed, at the core, what we found was the notion that to be bored is to want but be unable to engage in satisfying activity. And it's a very painful, restless, aversive state where the person is sort of like really yearning for some kind of mental connection with the world, but isn't able to achieve that.
And is it somehow related to depression? Is that part of what you're getting at, too?
Well, we're still in the very early days of kind of understanding boredom from a scientific point of view in terms of doing research on it. But what we do know so far is that people who report that they often feel bored, so this might be described as trait boredom or their propensity to be bored, so people who often feel bored also are at a greater risk for experiencing depression. So we do know that these two things co-occur, but exactly why they're associated is still something that we're trying to disentangle. On an informal basis, I can tell you from interviewing people who struggled very chronically with profound depression, they told me that they experienced boredom as a sort of a very scary warning sign that a depressive episode might be around the corner.
Hmm.
Because when they felt bored, they became disengaged from the world and more inclined to start ruminating in more negative, depressogenic kinds of ways. And so they felt very anxious and restless when they saw, you know, boredom on the horizon. I can also tell you that there's a little bit of research showing that people who are both bored and depressed, when they are treated for their depression with medication, the mm-hmm. depression will lift, but the boredom remains.
Huh.
And so we do know that although they're associated, there does seem to be some reason to think they're still distinct things.
They're different. Well, mm-hmm. boredom, I think of as sort of a, I don't think of it as an inherently negative state, but when I think about one of the sort of equivalents that you write about, Linda, ennui, the French word, I think of that as something that's a little more cloaked in sadness, boredom plus something negative. Are there different ways to think about these, you know, just slight differences in states?
I think that there definitely are. And, you know, boredom, and in the conversations that I had with you, Dr. Eastwood, which were absolutely fascinating and very necessary to the article that I wrote, it was helpful for me to think of boredom as sort of on a scale, and that, you know, it may be sort of essentially the same idea, this sort of disengagement and not being able to engage in the kind of attention that you want. But the degree of severity, I think you can possibly think about as kind of on this scale. And so, you know, ennui may be sort of sliding down to the more negative end of the spectrum. And I think, to be honest, I think this is part of the problem with studying boredom, is that most people associate boredom as this sort of somewhat benign state that kids feel. You know, you hear 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds saying, "Mom, I'm bored, Mom, I'm bored." You don't necessarily associate it with all of the negative psychosocial issues that it can be. And I think part of that does come from it being something that could be, can get worse. I think Dr. Eastwood could probably speak to whether or not that's an appropriate characterization to think of it as a scale, but it has been sort of helpful to me to think about it that way.
Well, and as you report, Linda, people who are bored more easily, it's not good. They start some of the things people do to cope with boredom. They start doing drugs. Maybe they have affairs. They tend to be more anxious. I mean, there seems to be this host of not so great things that can go along with chronic boredom.
Absolutely. And I think that's sort of one of the tragedies of not having really looked at boredom. And as Dr. Eastwood had pointed out, that, you know, it's clear that the depression and boredom, for example, are two distinct states that perhaps are related, but are definitely not the same thing. And, you know, neither is it anxiety, neither is it anything else. And so it has some serious implications, I think, about how you treat some of those those issues. So, you know, for example, if you are treating someone for depression but then don't take into account boredom and how they're able to deal with boredom or not able to deal with boredom, it can seriously impact, I think, their outcome, I would think. So it's an interesting problem. It's an interesting problem to think about.
Can you give us a little bit of the backstory on boredom, when it first appeared in human consciousness and where it's gone from there?
That's a really interesting question, not to make a joke, but there are definitely some people who think that boredom, there's a school of thought that boredom only began with the Enlightenment, that as people were sort of able to start questioning their place in sort of the great chain of being, is when they started to sort of chafe against those bonds, and that produced this disconnect, you know, not being able to do what they wanted to do, whatever that might be. I'm inclined to think that that's probably, you know, sort of with all due respect, I just can't buy that people are only now feeling boredom, that, you know, it's that it's something that's only really existed for the last 250 years. And I think there's a lot of evidence of that in writing that predates the Enlightenment. You know, in Christian tradition, there's this idea of acedia, which is kind of like a sloth. It's before sloth. It was a state that in the 3rd and 4th century was typically ascribed to people who were in sort of very cloistered environments. So, you know, monks and hermits and people who had cut themselves off from the world in order to sort of better commune with God. And they would kind of get into these states of being simultaneously listless and restless and not being able to do whatever it is that they wanted to do and sort of being highly stressed about that, but also, you know, not engaging with what they wanted to engage in. And it sounded a lot like boredom, and certainly sounds a lot like the sort of kind of boredom that Dr. Gieswood has been talking about. So that's from the 4th century, and I have to believe that boredom even existed well before that. I mean, you know, certainly there's graffiti on Roman walls from the 1st century that can probably uphold the fact that people even then, when they got bored, would do mildly destructive things. So I think it's been something that's existed for a while, but it's really only been in the last, say, 150, 200 years that we've had a conversation about it. And in the 18th century and 19th century, people would talk about boredom and distractibility and attention and how people would pay attention. So I think it's something that people have always felt, but as we're more able to talk about our various mental states, it's a conversation that people have had more recently.
And John, as you study boredom and try to understand it, is the holy grail of research like that a cure for boredom? I can't imagine popping a pill to stop being bored, but I don't know.
I wouldn't say that for me the holy grail is to try to develop a cure for boredom. In fact, you know, I think as you said off the top of the show, that boredom is a very common, it's kind of a, maybe even a natural or expected or inevitable human state, and I don't think we need to pathologize that. But I do think, you know, as Linda's been saying, that boredom does exist on a continuum, and it can become very protracted, very extreme, very chronic, and very painful. So you can think about, you know, worry or anxiety or even sadness, you know, all kinds of different human emotions that do exist on a continuum, and not all forms of anxiety are pathological, but some can be. And similarly, I think that boredom can be a real problem for some people, and they can go to, you know, really great lengths and engage in really unhelpful or unhealthy behavior to try to get rid of this state. And I think in that way it's important for us to understand what causes it, what it tells us about the human condition, what it tells us about how to construct society and social systems, so that we can alleviate those more chronic forms or those more pathological forms of boredom.
Well, we're talking about boredom this hour with our guest Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie. She's a freelance journalist, and her recent article, The History of Boredom, ran in the Smithsonian Magazine. And also joining us, John Eastwood, an associate professor of psychology at York University. He's currently studying boredom, trying to understand just exactly what it is. And we're curious about your insights on boredom. Do you think it's inherently a negative condition, or are there upsides to being bored? How do you cope with boredom in yourself and with your children? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And I hope you'll stay with us next hour. We're going to be talking about the physics of Santa with an expert who knows whereof he speaks. And we'll also be talking about ways to give back during the holidays. It's not too late to think about that. This hour, we're thinking about boredom with our guest Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie, who wrote an article called The History of Boredom that just ran in Smithsonian Magazine, and John Eastwood, who's an associate professor of psychology at York University, and he's studying boredom and just exactly what it means. It seems to be part of the human condition, but how do we cope with it? How do you cope with it? And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Marianne joining us from Crystal Lake, Illinois. Hi, Marianne.
Hi. I have actually two comments, because some of the things you talked about made me think of something else. Some time ago, I had a clinical depression, and I'd had to take medication, and I used that time. It gave me a respite in order to solve the problems, and I don't need the medication anymore. However, I wasn't bored. It was more that I was not interested. It was hard to get interested in things. But the other thing is, I think there's a positive to boredom. I think that if you have some boring, rote, routine thing you're doing, at least for me, it can drain off just enough energy to allow my mind to think about things. I can solve problems that way. I can come up with new ideas that way. However, you do have to teach kids how to do that. And if you pack all of their time with finite stuff, things that are tangible, and you don't teach them how to let their minds wander, if you will, then they will get in trouble. But if you can harness that, you've got a lot of creativity there.
Yeah, those are some great points, Marianne. Thank you for bringing those up. And John, we'll begin with you, but it seems like Marianne is getting at that coping with boredom is a life skill, and you need to learn how to do it over the course of a lifetime, and also that boredom can have this creative side, this really fertile side to it as well.
Mm-hmm, yeah. There's a number of points there we could kind of pick up and pursue. For me, it's important to make a distinction between being in an environment that isn't overstimulating and being bored. And I don't see those two to be the same thing. So, as Marianne is saying, I think it's very healthy and very valuable to have downtime, to have quiet moments, to allow your thoughts to wander. But while your mind is wandering, I would say you're not bored because you're engaged in those thoughts. And I think that, we're so used to being on the end of very almost aggressive stimulation, loud movies, ever-present music. And I think that dulls our capacity to engage our mind when the noise dies down and to sort of more actively then engage with the world. And so absolutely, I think, unplugging, I guess we might say, to sum it up, I think unplugging is a very healthy thing, and being able to cope with an unplugged state is a valuable skill. But I think being bored or feeling bored is that real restless lethargy that kicks in when someone isn't able to engage themselves. And I don't think that that's a healthy state.
And what do you think, Linda?
I think there's a lot in what the caller just said that's really interesting. Again, sorry. I think picking up on the point of the link with creativity, there's been a lot of conversation about and a lot of research about the link between mind wandering, daydreaming, and creativity. Specifically, that your brain does need some time to sort of not be actively thinking, I suppose, and that might not be the best way to characterize it, but to be in a state where you can turn over something in your brain and to sort of let your mind wander. And I think that the caller is accurate, that to some degree we don't teach our kids how to do that. And I think that part of that comes from this sort of social fear of being bored. And I know that I personally feel that, and certainly as I've done research into this project, I found myself being a little bit more aware of the fact that, you know, for example, I had to go to the doctor's office a couple weeks ago, and I brought three books with me. Three. I didn't. I was going to be there for 20 minutes, maybe. But I had this fear that I would have time and not have a way to occupy it, and that I would be sitting there, this feeling of sort of, I'm not doing anything, but I need to be doing something. And so I think that at the moment, there's a lot of sort of throwing things at our children that to get them occupied and to have them do things. And that there is a sense of not teaching them how to have that time to sit with themselves. And I think that's something that even in a discussion sort of a deeper boredom, sort of as you slide down the scale, there was a poet, Joseph Brodsky, who in, I think, 1995, did a commencement speech at Dartmouth College where he encouraged the people, the graduating students, to be bored, to learn how to get bored. Because he said in that moment, you sort of hit bottom, and that's when you confront yourself in a way, and you have to learn how to live with yourself. And I think that there's a lot of there's a lot to be mined from that, and a lot about learning how to be comfortable with yourself that is a skill that could potentially be learned, and that it's possible that we're just not teaching as well as we should.
And our next caller might be able to speak to this as well. We've got Carrie on the line from Milwaukee. Hi, Carrie.
Hi there. You guys actually just kind of put words right out of my mouth. I'm an art teacher in Milwaukee, and I work with a population that I guess most would call at risk, but more caused by nurture. They're all anxious and have a propensity towards depression. And so every once in a while, and hopefully my administrators don't care because I don't think they know I do this, I have these blissfully boring days, and that's what I call them. And there's no rule. You can sit. You can. I have laid out in the classroom 100 million different materials. I've got a graffiti board in my room that I have a quote or two, and you're welcome to go and make your mark if you need to. But my primary goal is to teach these kids that have a propensity to be depressed and anxious that boredom is not their enemy, and that our times of boredom are actually when we find out a profound amount of things about ourselves and our abilities and our interests. And especially when in a time where we are always on with media and information and things like that, we need those quiet times just to be and to be within our own mind. And so a lot of the times, you know, somebody might get a good beat going with their hands if they don't want to make something. But generally, the things created in the room on the blissfully boring days are tremendous. And they really, really work. And it helps to calm my kids down because they start to learn that their anxiety, that quiet time, doesn't have to be scary.
So they like it. This is something that you're not foisting on them. There's good stuff coming out of that, Carrie.
There's totally good stuff coming out of there. Now, I might have new students fairly often, they're very worried about it because, you know, when you're dealing with anxiety, sometimes that quiet time is a very scary place to go to. But once they get comfortable with the idea that, oh, everybody else in the room is doing this, I guess I'm doing it too, do start to like it. And I'll tell you the conversations that have sparked afterwards, you know, that are just being produced from what somebody was thinking have been tremendous. And the kids that have been with me for a long time are really look forward to the blissfully boring days.
That's such a cool idea. What do you think about that kind of approach, John?
Yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense to me. I think I would agree with everything that's been said. You know, I think when we sort of unplug from that onslaught of constant stimulation, it gives us a chance to really look inward and reflect and to sort of find ourselves, to find our interests, to find our passions, and to find ways that we can then more actively go out into the world and engage. And I think that that blissful state is the state when there's a dance between us and the world. We have an intention, we have a goal, and then we deploy our attention into the world, and we're able to kind of notice nuances in things and then respond accordingly. And it's that engaged flow-like state that is such a, it's inherently rewarding in its own right, and it then results in all kinds of, great human accomplishments. And I think that if we try to get away from the feeling of boredom by just rushing to stimulate ourselves, we miss that opportunity. And not only do we miss that opportunity, I think we set ourselves up for increased boredom in the future. Because, as Carrie's saying, we don't learn how, we don't develop the skill to deal with those moments when the stimulation is turned down.
I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're trying to understand boredom this hour on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, talking with Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie, who wrote The History of Boredom, an article in the Smithsonian Magazine, and John Eastwood, an associate professor of psychology at York University. And Linda, do you have any sense of how our society's use of all of this crazy tech gadgetry has affected boredom?
I would be inclined to say that, I think there's definitely a lot of thought that we're sort of getting faster at everything, and that we are, and I think Dr. Eastwood actually said this to me, and I think this is an interesting observation, that we are seeing ourselves as, we're conceiving ourselves as vessels that need to be filled, almost, that we're not as active in pursuing something, that we are passive in our enjoyment of life, and that's, I think, problematic. And going back to actually what the caller had said, I have to say, hey, thank you very much for being a phenomenal teacher, Carrie, because blissfully boring days sounds absolutely wonderful. But I think the really important thing that I got out of that was you also need to give people tools in their boredom. So rather than arming them with a smartphone to alleviate their boredom, arm them with a pen and paper. And I think that sort of tool is necessary so that they can help themselves get out of that boredom. But I would also caution against suggesting that sort of our current form of life is somehow bad or wrong or contributing to an overwhelming sort of spiraling into boredom and an inability to get ourselves out of it. Because I don't want to engage in that kind of golden age nostalgic thinking that somehow 100 years ago it was better. Certainly you see writing in the 18th, 19th century where authors are talking about how they need to write shorter so that their audience can, which has such a short attention span. Since the 18th century, they have such a short attention span, so they need to write shorter so that they don't lose their audience. And, people even then were worried about the sort of vast proliferation of written material and the effect that was having on, society's sort of general ability to pay attention to things. So I don't want to be sort of Luddite and think that it was so much better back before we had smartphones and things like that. But I do think and acknowledge that there is a little bit of a concern that we are, that it's too easy to be entertained now, and that we are sort of, like a drug. If we, the more we do, the more we need, and this is something that we kind of need to suppress in ourselves and learn how to, perhaps go back to having a pen and paper to alleviate boredom and not an iPad.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phone lines now and take our next call from Stefan in Milwaukee. Hi, Stefan.
Good morning. It's a great show.
Thanks.
The father of five children, boredom comes up a lot, but with my younger children, I let them know that if they come to me and they say, well, I'm bored, I tell them a couple of things. First of all, I tell them, you're watching too much TV because they tend to zone out. Secondly, I tell them that boredom comes from within, so you're the one that controls it. And thirdly, I tell them to go read a book or play an instrument to, or even research something on the internet that they're interested in. And I'm wondering if I set them up for psychological failure. The second point I'd like to make is when I was in the service in basic training, the dictum was hurry up and wait.
Mm-hmm.
And one time I tried to sneak in a book because I was bored, and my top sergeant caught me with a book, and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm bored." He said, "Good, I want you to be bored." And I said, "Well, why is that?" He said, "So you can recognize it, so when you're on patrol, you know that if you become bored, you need to re-alert yourself or to know when you're not being alert." So he said, there's a reason for you being bored.
Wow. I never would have thought of that. Thanks for sharing those stories, Stefan. I think Stefan's ideas are pretty good. I don't know. I have heard myself saying to my kids, if you're bored, then you're boring, which even I know sounds lame, but I can't think of anything better other than suggesting lists of things to do. And sometimes it works suggesting things to other people, and sometimes it doesn't. I don't know. Professor Eastwood, is there a good way to combat boredom with children, to kind of steer them toward engagement?
Well, I think let me try to link up a couple of Stefan's comments. I mean, I think helping kids become aware, being able to self-monitor and notice, okay, this is what this state feels like, so they can identify it, and then help them learn how to then become engaged. And I think it's important to take instances of boredom in their unique case, because there may not be universal solutions for every kid or for every situation. There might be something very specific that boredom in that moment is telling you. Perhaps the child is feeling anxious and feeling ineffective and has disengaged from a task because they feel like a failure. And that might be important to understand and then address. But I also think that some kids just have difficulty engaging. And so in addition to providing lists of activities or suggestions, sometimes modeling engagement or helping them get started. You know, you might say to them, "Well, I know that you often like reading books. Why don't we sit down together and pick out a book?" And then the parent can kind of help the child get into that activity. So mm-hmm. I think there's a number of neat ideas there in what Stefan has shared with us.
Well, we're talking this hour about boredom and its history, its causes, and its cures. Our guests are Linda Rodriguez McRobbie. She wrote an article called The History of Boredom that ran in the Smithsonian Magazine recently. And John Eastwood, who's an associate professor of psychology at York University. And we're wondering what you think. How do you cope with boredom in your own life? Do you think of it as a positive, or is it a negative that you feel may be sliding toward depression? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also check in on our Facebook page at The Veronica Rickert Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up at 1 o'clock today, join us for Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Today, get out your binoculars. It's time for the annual Christmas bird count. Join Ira Flato for a look at which feathered friends you may see this winter. Plus, a new planet discovery has astronomers abuzz about the search for life. That's 1 o'clock's Talk of the Nation Science Friday. This hour, we're examining boredom with our guest Linda Rodriguez McRobbie, who wrote the article The History of Boredom for Smithsonian Magazine, and John Eastwood, an associate professor of psychology at York University. He's currently studying boredom. And we've got a couple of emailed comments here. This is from Jim in Osceola, who says, "The educational theorist Madeline Hunter opines that interest follows knowledge. That is, you won't be interested in, for example, stamp collecting until you know something about it." And another from Kirk, who emailed in wondering if there have been studies of meditation related to the study of boredom. And Linda, why don't we go to you first?
I'm not entirely sure there's been a ton of studies done linking boredom and meditation, but I did speak with a doctor who's also a Buddhist. And I think there's a lot of there's a lot to be mined from that in particular, and from sort of the Buddhist idea of being able to be with yourself, basically. And something that was not too far away from what Joseph Brodsky was talking about and encouraging the students, the graduating class of Dartmouth, to be bored. That there is this sort of sense of being able to learn how to take that time to live with yourself. And that, and perhaps in meditation, which can sometimes be a little dull, that you're able to take that time to learn how to, I suppose, quiet your mind and to, well, again, to be with yourself.
Mm-hmm. And what about the idea about interest following knowledge?
I find that probably pretty accurate, and certainly something that I experienced in the going to the Boring Conference. That, you know, I didn't know why I should be interested in the Yamaha PSR-175 until someone told me a little bit more about it. But I also, I think I have a 16-month-old boy, and he is interested in everything he's never seen before. And I know that I can, even if I'm not entirely acquainted with it, I can become more interested in it, and that there is a sort of sense of novelty being, and seeking novelty being, an alleviation of boredom. So, well, I think that that's probably accurate, that interest does follow knowledge. It's probably not the case all the time. But it is an interesting, you know, I think it's an interesting way to think about boredom in education, and particularly rather maybe interest not so much following knowledge as interest following engagement and an application to self, to understanding why this should apply to me, why this information that I'm learning is somehow relevant. So perhaps interest follows relevance.
Can I jump in on that?
Yeah, comment? Please.
So I just want to really echo and reinforce what Linda just said there about interest and knowledge. I think I appreciate the spirit of that quote, the idea that knowledge is necessary for interest. But I also think engagement is a really important concept here. I think it was Susan Sontag that talked about interest and boredom being two sides of the same coin,
mm-hmm.
and that they both involve an external, being outside of a situation rather than inside it. And I think that engagement, that deep immersion, is what's really important. And with respect to meditation, we do know, I mean, that's an area that's still quite underdeveloped. I'm not a Buddhist scholar, but I understand that meditation teachers and Buddhist thinkers do talk quite a bit about boredom and its relationship with meditation. We do know that mindfulness, a particular form of meditation, and to some degree it's been thought of as a personality trait, so that is the ability to be fully present and attending to bodily sensations in the moment in a non-judgmental attitude, that ability to be present, or that a trait of mindfulness, is associated with less boredom proneness. So correlational studies have definitely shown a link, but I'm not aware of any kind of experimental studies yet that have sort of understood, does mindfulness training or meditation cause a reduction in boredom? I mean, that would be an interesting thing to look at.
John, do we have any idea what's happening in the brain during states of boredom via brain imaging?
We don't have that. Again, that's a very new area, and I'm only aware of a couple studies that have looked at that. And to me, what's interesting about that research is you know, so they brought people into the lab and they, you know, have them in fMRI or brain scanners and looking at their brain activity. And the interesting thing for me there is that most cognitive psychology experiments involve having a participant in a lab in a very unreal, artificial environment where they might be, even be immobilized, they might be staring at a computer screen. It's pretty boring. And if we know now that being bored results in a particular kind of brain signature, it's possible that a whole host of our previous studies on mental ability and cognition, you might say, is confounded, or it's complicated. It's hard for us to interpret those results, because not only were the people doing the task that the researchers wanted them to do, they were also bored. And so it's kind of like that was overlaid on top of what,
right,
whatever information the researchers were getting from their individual studies. So I think we need to think about how boredom might be complicating our ability to study human cognition if we're not more careful with the way we design our studies.
If I can jump in with a question, actually, for Dr. Eastwood, one of the things that I've seen come up several times in discussing attention, boredom, and distractibility is the default state scan or the resting state scan.
Mm-hmm.
If you can maybe talk a little bit about that, because I've seen it, I see a lot of applications for that in understanding what's happening when, in your brain when you're not really asked to do anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that, you know... Okay, so there's an interesting question there. So the default state, this is a term that neuropsychologists have used to refer to the state the brain is in when it's not engaged in any task in the external world. So you're told to just sit there and you're not given anything particular to do. And people tend to focus on more internal state, internal things at that point. Their mind might wander to plans for the evening or what they want to have for lunch that day. But I think as soon as your mind starts to become engaged with internal thoughts, I would say that you're no longer bored because you're now lost in that that kind of reverie or those daydreaming states. So I think mind wandering in the default state on the one hand is probably distinct from boredom on the other hand.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Well, it sounds like there's some cool research to be done there down the road. And let's go back to the phones. We've got George, who's with us from Milwaukee. Hi, George.
Hi. Something you had said earlier about if you the more you know about something, the more interesting it is, I think is really true. There's a book that I read a number of years ago called Prairie Earth by William Lee Teetmoon, the author of another great book called Blue Highways. Lee Teetmoon was interested in seeing if he could make interesting what most people would perhaps find one of the most boring places in the United States. And so he chose to study Chase County, Kansas, right in the middle of Kansas. And in a 700-page book, he goes on to tell us everything about the geology, the botany, the wildlife, the prehistoric people, the frontiers folks, crop growing, railroads, Dust Bowl, you name it. And it turns out that it's an absolutely fascinating book of an area of the world that most people would never give a second thought to.
Wow. So the lesson there is, I guess, you can find something interesting in anything.
I was just thinking back to where Linda started with the boring conference. You know, I think there's a real yearn or like there's people really want to be able to celebrate the mundane, you know, want to be able to slow down and engage in the everyday life. And I think we... You know, we live in this overhyped world, you know, everything is 110% better, or this sort of everything is new and the best yet. And there's this desire to just kind of slow down and to engage with and celebrate the everyday.
I think that's really important to remember that undercurrent has probably always existed and will always exist, that even as we sort of... see everything accelerate to the point where, you know, it's difficult to know how fast technology and how fast we'll be living, essentially, in the next, you know, 20 years or so, that even at the same time, there are always people who want to take life a bit slower and who are sort of rebelling against the notion that bigger, better, you know, that bigger is better and faster is better, and that constantly being in contact with your friends via Facebook or, you know, constantly being able to access YouTube on your phone wherever you need it is better. I think it's really important to know that that throughout history, people have always felt that, I think.
Yeah,
and I know, Linda, that you were talking about how you don't want to be nostalgic about, you know, the days before technology was such a part of our lives. But it does seem as though, you know, where you might have seen people maybe gazing off into space, thinking about things or coming up with ideas because they're bored. I mean, it's so easy just to be, you know, like a rat clicking that button to get a little hit of stimulation on your phone. I don't know. I feel like I personally maybe have a lower tolerance for boredom than I used to because of all the gadgets that are around me.
I think that I probably feel that way as well. But I also want to take into account things that, you know, for example, when Acedia, which is a sort of Christian thought of, you know, early Christian understanding of boredom, essentially, became sloth. It became a sin. And so, you know, there's that phrase, the devil makes work for idle hands. The notion that you could ever be idle under sort of a Puritan understanding of the world is to say that it's bad and it's wrong and that you shouldn't. So I feel like there's always been a curve towards keeping people away from being bored, away from being able to daydream, you know, away from being able to let their mind wander. And now we're sort of doing it in a different way. We're doing it by filling the void with you know, videos of funny cats and things like that. but that there's always been something, you know, there's always been work or, you know, people worrying that novels were dangerous because it was engaging your mind in sort of a not productive way.
I think Linda is right to remind us, you know, the historical context here, you know, and I would agree with what she's saying. I think another way you could look at this is to say, well, what is the unique social meaning or relatively unique social meaning that boredom has for us today? So we might say that the state has been with us forever, and earlier we were talking about it historically. We can also look at this cross-culturally. Does boredom occur across cultures? Is it universal in that sense? We could even look at it within the animal world, right? And there, you know, people that, you know, study animal behavior talk about animal boredom, and animals in zoos and impoverished cages will literally, you know, gnaw their own limbs off for stimulation and that kind of thing. So I think we could start from the premise that there's a state here which is fairly universal and historically longstanding, and then ask, but how it's interpreted or how meaning is made around it is going to vary depending on the context.
Yeah. I think that's really an important way to look at this, because the other thing that you know you don't want to do, looking at it say historically, is to apply our 21st century values onto something that might not have worked the same and worked in the same way in society. And I know that there have been studies done, sort of anthropological studies, for example, of Aboriginal cultures in Australia, and the understanding of boredom there being a little bit more akin to loneliness, that if you're alone and not in a community setting, that's kind of like boredom. So I think it is really important to see boredom outside our sort of understanding of it and as a Western cultural phenomenon.
Well, we've only got a couple minutes left in the hour. I want to squeeze in one more phone call. Sarah from Appleton. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I just want to tell you thank you so much for airing this program. I wish I would have heard this when I was 13 years old.
I bet a lot of us feel that way.
Yeah. I have been bored my whole entire life until I was about 25. I've made horrible decisions in my teen years, and I was completely reckless and wild because I got bored so easy. And I don't get bored as easily anymore. When I turned 25, it kind of went away.
Interesting.
But I still make really bad decisions when I start getting bored, and I get anxiety really bad. And I was just wondering if there's a correlation with boredom and attention deficit, because I have that really bad.
Okay, well, thank you for those questions and for sharing your experience. It's thought-provoking that at 25 it just kind of went away. And John, let's let you answer this one.
Well, we definitely know that attention deficit disorder and boredom proneness are associated or correlated. So both children and adults that have been diagnosed with attention deficit disorder complain of boredom, experience boredom more often than those that don't have that challenge or that difficulty. And, you know, that really fits for us in the way we're understanding boredom, because we're really putting attention ability at the core, right? And so attention is the mental mechanism whereby we engage with the world, where we filter certain information, where we select certain information to focus on to the exclusion of others, where we hold distractions at bay to stay focused on a goal. And if that capacity is weaker for some reason, perhaps chronically because of, you know, constitutional difficulties, or even temporarily because we haven't slept well, we're going to be more likely to be bored. And so, yes, indeed, you know, boredom is something that folks with attention deficit disorder seem to struggle with more often.
Well, we're about out of time, but I want to thank you both so much for being with us. It has been, of course, an interesting hour. Linda, thanks.
You're welcome.
Linda Rodriguez-McRavi, a freelance journalist. Her recent article, The History of Boredom, ran in the Smithsonian Magazine. And also joining us, John Eastwood, who is an associate professor of psychology at York University, who's currently working to understand boredom. And I want to thank Rhonda Fanning and Brittany DeAnda, both for schlepping in through all the snow and ice, digging out their cars, getting stuck, getting pushed, etc. And also for producing this program, for running the board, and Brittany for answering phone calls and filling in for Marika Suval today. Well, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm wishing you a very interesting weekend, and stay tuned to the Ideas Network. That's one way to get there. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.